Good afternoon. My name is Wes, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the CAP Action and NSN conference call on Palanti foreign policy speech. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. I'll now turn the conference over to Anna Solner. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for joining us for the CAP Action NSN call on Governor Pawlenty's approach to foreign policy and the GOP divide. My name's Anna Solner. My phone number is 202-492-2967. That's 202-492-2967. If you need to reach me after the call to follow up with any of our speakers, I will be available for you. I just want to remind you all that this call will be recorded and the audio will be posted both at the NSN as well as the CAP Action websites after the call. In delivering a major foreign policy speech addressing the Arab Spring at the Council on Foreign Relations this morning, Tim Pawlenty exposed the deepening divisions among conservatives on national security. We've brought together today four experts to react to the speech delivered this morning and to address this increasing divide. Joining us are Heather Hurlburt, Executive Director of the National Security Network, who will discuss the overall policy divide among conservatives, Ken Goode, Managing Director of the National Security and International Policy Program at CAP Action, who will lay out the points of inconsistency in Pawlenty's approach, Peter Jewell, policy analyst at CAP Action, who's our resident expert on the intellectual foundations of conservative foreign policy, and Lawrence Korb, a veteran of the Reagan administration and a senior fellow here at CAP Action, who will also share his analysis. Heather, can you please kick us off?
Thanks, Anna, and thanks so much for having me on the call. Pawlenty's speech really comes at a fascinating moment where we're seeing a degree of incoherence among conservative presidential candidates, conservative leaders in Congress, and the conservative base, but a level of incoherence that it's hard to remember in the history of American foreign policy since maybe 1968, when the Democratic base deserted their foreign policy establishment en masse with results that we know for the next 20 or 30 years of policy. But, you know, dating back to last fall, we've seen this kind of really nasty internecine sniping with Pat Buchanan on the one side and Mark Thiessen on the other. You know, people like Senator McCain, who, of course, was the party standard bearer in the last election, getting into the act. Lindsey Graham telling his fellow senators to sort of shut up in terms of how they should debate the war in Libya, and then Romney and Gingrich trying, frankly, to be on both sides at the same time, with Gingrich first lambasting the administration for not imposing a no-fly zone over Libya, and then less than 3 weeks later lambasting them for imposing a no-fly zone over Libya. Romney being very unclear where he stands about Afghanistan. Pawlenty giving a speech today, which my colleagues will discuss in more detail, but which is a speech about the Middle East that doesn't talk about oil prices, that doesn't talk about economic issues, that doesn't talk about nuclear weapons, that devotes one sentence to Iraq and one sentence to Afghanistan. It's a really rather remarkably sort of incoherent moment. And then you watch, frankly, the conservative foreign policy establishment, which has many people that we all respect and who've been our colleagues for a long time, you know, frankly, sort of trying to police what's going on in the political environment with mixed degrees of success. And you have George Will pleading the idea that one could be a conservative and not an isolationist. And if you compare this, I mean, even to 10 years ago in 2000, and I think Peter will speak more to this, where you had Condoleezza Rice writing articles in Foreign Affairs about what her candidate's foreign policy would look like in a very serious way that were then reflected in the debate. And it's very difficult to imagine that level of seriousness out on the hustings this time at a moment where arguably the real challenges we face in national security and, frankly, in economics and how that connects up to national security are far more profound than they were in the wonderful days of the internet bubble in 2000. And that's just a really striking and frankly a very sad moment for a movement that had great internationalism and great concern with the world's problems at its heart at various moments, and it's just a quite remarkable thing to see. And with that, I'll pass it over to Ken.
Great. Thanks, Heather. And I think she lays out a pretty stark assessment of the conservative foreign policy establishment. And when you dig into the details of Tim Pawlenty's speech here today, you really get a stark assessment of what it is that they're actually trying to do. And it's pretty much a shambles, and really betrays the fact that none of these candidates, Pawlenty first on the list, did not have any formal national security experience at all. And you can see that with a lot of the inconsistencies that he proposes in this particular speech. And Heather touched on some of the things that he omitted, but let's not forget the errors of commission that he made in his speech today. You know, first, he is very critical of the Obama administration on Egypt. He singles out them for cutting foreign assistance to Egypt early in their administration, but then he seems to have an odd conversion within the same speech when he says he speaks to the Egyptian people out of friendship and honesty when he says that he would cut foreign assistance to Egypt in order to spur Egyptian economic growth. Now, that doesn't seem to make very much sense to me. On U.S.-Saudi relations, he quite accurately points out that U.S.-Saudi relations are pretty bad right now. But then he has a pretty odd prescription for restoring the trust between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. His first suggestion is that Saudis must radically transform their society or face violent revolution. And then he says that the United States must never pressure Israel to do anything. Now, if you know, it doesn't seem to be a very viable pathway towards restoring trust between the United States and Saudi Arabia to make demands about their internal situation and to cozy up to the Israelis as your number one policy for the region. So that doesn't make sense. Then he talks in great depth, or at least in great length, about the evils of the Assad regime in Syria and how he was very quick to condemn them. And how the Syrians are essentially the only thing propping up the Iranian regime or the only thing standing in the way of violent revolution in Iran, and that we would all be better off if Assad would go. He seems then to, though, lack any specifics. His policy boils down to basically tell Assad to go, and if he doesn't, we'll say go again. And that just doesn't match the level of criticism that he's delivered towards the Obama administration on its Syria policy, nor the threat that he describes Syria as posing to the region. And I'll just note one last point. He seems to be particularly worried about the relative strength of Iran in the Middle East, yet he completely neglects what everyone recognizes as the most significant factor impacting Iran's relative strength. And that is the United States' war to remove Iran's largest enemy, Saddam Hussein, from Iraq. If you ask any Saudi, if you ask anyone in the Gulf, the number one thing that they cite for Iran's relative increase in strength, and I would say relative increase in strength, is that the United States eliminated their biggest enemy. And if you don't recognize that about the current power dynamics in the Middle East, you don't really recognize anything. And I think that's indicative of Tim Pawlenty's approach to the region, and I think that's indicative of his approach to foreign policy.
Great. Peter?
Well, picking up off of a couple things that Heather said at the beginning, I think Tim Pawlenty is clearly positioning himself within this internecine Republican foreign policy fight as a candidate of the conservative foreign policy establishment as it's emerged over the last 10 years here in Washington. He is very much taking the McCain-Graham line in attacking supposed isolationism for opposing the war in Libya or wanting to draw down in Afghanistan, and it's just broader indication of the dysfunction that conservatives are facing when it comes to talking, thinking, and acting on foreign policy. Pawlenty, for example, you know, is in support of, you know, the McCain-Lindsey Graham line, which is also the line of magazines like the Weekly Standard, the American Enterprise Institute, and the Heritage Foundation, whereas, you know, you get Mitt Romney trying to split the difference on Afghanistan. You have Michelle Bachmann supporting a continued war in Afghanistan while opposing the war in Libya, and you know, you have Ron Paul, who opposes all wars everywhere all the time. And you just don't really see any sort of coherent theme coming out of Republican and conservative foreign policy at this point. And Pawlenty is just trying to stake out his ground. Actually, I think it's a unique attempt, whereas it seems like the other conservative candidates are sort of pulling back from the more aggressive foreign policy that President Bush pursued during his time in office. Pawlenty is actually rather unique in staking out and defending that sort of foreign policy in this speech and in his criticisms of other conservative candidates this year.
Thank you, Peter. Larry?
As the last living Eisenhower Republican, let me say that Pawlenty doesn't even understand the Republican Party history. When he talks, he's confusing isolationism with realism. Would he have called Eisenhower an isolationist for getting out of Korea, Nixon getting out of Vietnam, Reagan getting out of Libya, and I can tell you from personal experience, refusing to send troops to Central America. When he hits up Obama for trying to engage Iran, doesn't he remember that we engaged with worse during the Cold War, including the Soviet Union? The first president, Bush, engaged with China even after Tiananmen Square, sending Brent Scowcroft over within weeks of that horrible situation, and forgetting the fact that in 2003, the second president, Bush, ignored Iran's attempts to reach out and engage us. And had we done that, I think things would be a lot different there. When he's talking about Israel, he seems to forget that the Israelis were not happy about what happened, you know, particularly with Mubarak and even some of them about Assad, because they preferred the status quo. When he talks about Libya and using America's strength, is he for or against using ground troops? He's not clear on that. And then finally, when he hits up Obama on Israel, he seems to forget that if you want to look at someone who was tough on Israel, go back and look at the first President Bush, who threatened to cut off loan guarantees if the Israelis did not stop the settlements. His Secretary of State, Jim Baker, said unless Israel drops its quote-unquote hardline conditions, the United States would not get engaged. In fact, in a sort of a dramatic statement before the Congress, he gave his phone number out and said, well, when you change your mind, call me and we can get involved again. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Wes, we're ready to go to questions.
And ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. At this time, I'm showing no questions.
Okay, thanks so much, Wes. Again, would anyone like to make any final comments from our group? All right. Well, I'd like to thank you all for joining us for the call today. Again, my name is Anna Solner. If you have any follow-up questions, my number is 202-492-2967. That's 202-492-2967. Again, audio will be available shortly on the Center for American Progress Action Fund website, as well as the National Security Network websites. Thanks again to Heather Hurlburt, Ken Goode, Peter Jewell, and Lawrence Korb, and thanks to all of you for joining us.